Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
After years of waiting, Nigel Wright, the former Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister, breaks his silence as he takes the stand at the trial for Senator Mike Duffy. New details of the scandal are emerging that have prompted more questions about the Prime Minister's knowledge of the scheme and the actions of his staff. We get insight from a former Director of Communications to Prime Minister Paul Martin and reaction from a former law clerk to the House of Commons.
We also take a look at the developments in the case with the McLean's panel, which looks at the political impact this may have on the Conservative campaign.
Conservative leader Stephen Harper has been squaring off with some premiers during the campaign, although his biggest target is Ontario's Kathleen Wynne. Paul Wells sits down with Wynne to discuss her battle with Harper and her provincial pension plan that has Tories fuming.
And the NDP is hoping to take out Finance Minister Joe Oliver in this election with a former finance minister. John Geddes speaks to New Democrat candidate Andrew Thompson, who is running in the Toronto riding of Eglinton Lawrence.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
What are you going to say today in your testimony?
What do you mean by good to go, sir?
And vous pourrez, monsieur, right, that témoignage?
How much did the Prime Minister know?
I think we have to respect that the questions will be answered on the inside.
Nigel Wright, the former Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister, finally broke his silence on the Senate scandal when he arrived at the Ottawa courthouse this week for his first day of testimony in the trial for Senator Mike Duffy. We had been waiting to hear Wright's side of the story since news first broke in 2013 that he made a secret deal with the senator and personally paid him $90,000 so he could reimburse the taxpayer for questionable expenses. Along with his testimony, both the Crown and Defense have submitted hundreds of pages of emails between some of the top people in Prime Minister Stephen Harper's inner circle. In February of that year, the small group began crafting messages to put out the political fire. When more media stories fanned the flames, this group worked with Senate leadership to try and fix the problem for their troubled caucus member, properly repay the taxpayer, and protect the integrity of the government. None of that went according to plan.
Politically speaking, the Crown's questioning went well for Stephen Harper. Wright confirmed Harper was never told of the personal check or about the original plan to have the Conservative Party foot the bill. But as the defense took over and reporters sifted through the emails, the narrative started to shift. We found out Wright thought Duffy had a legal argument to claim his expenses, but with the approval from the Prime Minister, tried to force him to pay the money back. The defense claims Wright and others deceived Canadians by telling the public Duffy repaid the cash when they knew he didn't touch a dime of his own money. The PMO also dictated the Senate leadership's response to the scandal, basically forced Duffy to take part in the scheme when he resisted, and significantly altered a report that was supposed to be written by a Senate subcommittee. A couple of times, the Prime Minister himself weighed in on parts of the plan.
But at the end of the week, the focus turned from Harper's former chief of staff to his current chief of staff, Ray Novak. The emails filed as evidence show Novak may have been aware of the fact that Wright personally paid Duffy's improper expense tab, even though Harper has always said this was just between Duffy and Wright. The Conservative Party says Novak never read that email. But on Friday, Harper took some tough questions from the media.
Mr. Harper, you say you found out about the truth about the Duffy deal in May 14th or 15th when you found out. But your cabinet ministers continued after that to speak in the House of Commons saying that it was only Nigel Wright who knew. They said there were no documents. This is all there is to it. Why did you allow that to continue when you knew that it wasn't the truth, that there were more people involved?
Well, look, I think let me be clear on what I've said on this all along. We were all told that Mr. Duffy had repaid his expenses. Mr. Duffy said that on national television. He had borrowed money from the bank, etc. That is what we all understood to be the truth. That is what the vast majority of, that's not what only the entire caucus thought and I thought, that is what the vast majority of our staff also believed was the case. When I found out that was not the truth, we made that very clear to the Canadian public. There are two people responsible for this. They are obviously Mr. Duffy himself and Mr. Wright, and those are the people being held responsible and accountable.
Hannah Thibodeau, CBC. You just mentioned in that answer a vast majority of staff believe that, but there were staff and very high-profile staff that knew otherwise. you know, for a few days you have been kind of evading that question about the deception done by many of your senior staff in the Duffy case, including Mr. Ray Novak. He's your current chief of staff, and he was told about Mr. Wright's check in emails directly with Mr. Wright. So why have you tolerated Mr. Novak's lying and even promoted him to current chief of staff who's traveling with you right
well,
now?
Well, I would simply not accept the premise of that question. These are the actions of Mr. Duffy and Mr. Wright. You hold people responsible for their own actions. You certainly don't hold subordinates responsible for the actions of their superiors. These are the two people who are responsible, and they are being held accountable.
But Liberal candidate Dominic LeBlanc is not buying Harper's answers.
Mr. Harper's entire story since this scandal broke has not been credible. I mean, let's go back. He said that Nigel Wright resigned, then, oh, sorry, he was fired. Minister after minister called Mr. Wright a man of integrity who did the right thing, and then they all went silent. The real sign of hypocrisy was his sanctimonious statement in the leaders' debate last week that the role of a leader when something goes wrong is to root out the problem and hold those accountable. Well, what did he do with Mr. Novak? He promoted him. Senator LeBreton and Senator Gerstein were intimately involved in efforts to whitewash or fudge an audit. They inappropriately called Deloitte's an independent audit firm. What happened to them? Well, Senator Gerstein continues to be the fundraiser for the Conservative Party, and Marjorie LeBreton appears to be playing a key role in this re-election campaign.
The testimony from Wright has lifted the curtain on how the Prime Minister's office dealt with a growing scandal. It's not easy to deal with a controversy, and someone who's familiar with that is Scott Reed. He was Director of Communications for Prime Minister Paul Martin, as Martin tried to keep power in the wake of the sponsorship scandal. Reed weighs in on crisis management from a PMO perspective.
Walk me through sort of the mindset of a controversy and the mindset at that point of what you want to do. I assume you just want to make it go away. You want to end the story as fast as possible.
That's right. So you back up by saying three things. One, let's rush to the end. What is the worst possible outcome of all of this? What is the worst possible characterization of this? What is the worst truth here? So, what really happened? How might it be portrayed in public on a reasonable basis? How might it be portrayed in public on a hostile basis? If you took the worst possible way of looking at it, what would that look like? And then you work backwards from that to try to guard against that outcome. That's thing number one. Thing number two is you try to move with haste. You want to be deliberate. You want to be smart. You don't want to make stupid mistakes. But you try to move with haste to try to limit the time in which you have to manage this in the public arena. And those things contradict one another, by the way. Moving quickly and moving smartly are hard to do in unison. That's why people who do damage control get paid a lot of money, not a little money. But those are the fundamental things you do. And so you end up in a process, it's almost in its first and initial steps, almost investigatory. What are we looking at here? What's the worst of all this? Okay, that's how it would be characterized in its worst manifestation. Let's see, can we withstand and can we sustain a characterization that is more innocent? Is this honest? Is this true? Will it sustain challenge? What are the facts that I don't know that are going to come back and bite me in the ass? That's where we are now.
Like, how much pressure is there on people in the PMO? Like, you know, obviously it's damage control, but it's damage control at sort of the highest level of government and the fate of, you know, an entire government maybe at stake.
Well, it's enormously stressful. I mean, obviously, I lived through the sponsorship scandal. So it's a punishing, wearing time when you're in the face of something like that. But, I mean, first of all, that's the job. And second of all, you're going to be held to a damned if you do, damned if you don't standard. So you've, and by that I mean this. You're going to have people coming up and criticizing you for failing to act more swiftly and, you know, why didn't you do this, why didn't you do that? But you're also going to be damned for moving too swiftly. So at the end of the day, you have to work this thing through and feel right in your gut about it. There's no alternative, and you know, there's no court of appeal that's going to help you out. So you kind of have to find your own way on this and be guided by your own instincts and by your own code, and by just, you know, obviously common sense. And you know, where people generally get into trouble on these things is where they demonstrate to the public that they are acting not in harmony with the public interest, but solely in their private interest. And when there's a divergence between what the public perceives to be as to their interest versus your interest, then you're in trouble. Because then you're in a fight, not with the media, not with the opposition, and not with critics, but then you're in a fight with the public. You're in a fight with the regular voter. You're in the fight with the middle class, Jane and Joe. And then you're in trouble. So that's the territory that you're fighting to work around all the time. And the thing that people are unsympathetic to is that when you're in that position, you're not choosing between good and bad. You're choosing between horrible and fatal. And so you just spend all day long getting to horrible, because horrible doesn't kill you.
That's Scott Reed, former director of communications to Prime Minister Paul Martin.
We're not done with our coverage of the Duffy trial. Still to come on the show, we speak with a former law clerk from the House of Commons about Nigel Wright's testimony. And later on in the show, we do sit down with Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne to discuss her battle with Stephen Harper over pensions. And we speak with a former finance minister who wants to defeat the current finance minister. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne joins us to discuss the war of words she's having with Conservative leader Stephen Harper. We speak with the NDP candidate and former finance minister who wants to take out the current finance minister. And we hear from the McLean's panel. But first,
Nigel Wright, the former chief of staff to the Prime Minister, is on the stand at the Mike Duffy trial because of the $90,000 check he gave to Duffy. That exchange of cash led to the bribery charge against Duffy. This is one of the most serious charges Duffy is facing, since it carries a maximum sentence of 14 years if someone is convicted. The Crown needs to prove without a reasonable doubt that Senator Duffy accepted the payment with corrupt intent.
So, has the Crown used its questioning effectively to state its case, or has it handed a gift to the defense? To weigh in on all of this, I called Rob Walsh, who served as law clerk to the House of Commons between 1999 and 2012. I guess to start things off, maybe I'll just ask you of what you think of the testimony so far, what you've heard from Nigel Wright, and then what you've seen through the emails that have come out.
Well, testimony so far is, for the most part, not terribly different or surprising relative to what we'd all seen reported before. Much of it was expected, except for the explanation of the good-to-go email. Some might have questions about the credibility of his explanation for that email, but your last question was, you know, what is about the emails? Well, I actually took some time to read through the emails yesterday, and in the month of February 2013, my goodness, it's an incredible amount of time and detail reflected in those emails. And clearly, the Mr. Wright and others in his office, the PMO, were working very actively to manage a political issue in defense of the government's reputation. And for that, they needed Mr. Duffy's cooperation. And a good part of their difficulty was in gaining Mr. Duffy's cooperation. But that, to me, indicates that what we're dealing with here is really a political matter. I'm talking now about the $90,000 transaction. Really is a political matter. I don't see it as one giving rise to criminal charges, as we now have against Mr. Duffy, but we'll have to wait and see how the judge ultimately decides that.
And of course, yes, it is the judge's final say as to whether this was bribery or not. But from what you saw from the original examination of the Crown, do you think the Crown has done enough to really prove its case?
No, I don't think so. In respect of bribery or fraud on the government or breach of trust relative to the $90,000 transaction, they have not made a case, as they must, beyond a reasonable doubt. Before Mr. Bain even got started, I think there was grounds for having reasonable doubts about whether Mr. Duffy was involved in a bribery situation or a fraud on the government or a breach of trust of the kind required under those provisions of the criminal code. We have to remember now that the court is looking at whether there's a criminal offense here. All the political
information and of great interest to the media and the public generally, and legitimately so, may not be determinative of whether there is a criminal offense been committed here. Through all this detail, the judge is looking for convincing evidence that the accused, Mr. Duffy, was guilty of criminal conduct. And I myself am looking at it the same way. And even before Mr. Bain started, I didn't see it. And certainly in the course of Mr. Bain's cross-examination, I see it even less so, in the sense that Mr. Bain only has to raise a reasonable doubt. Mr. Bain, on behalf of Mr. Duffy, doesn't have to prove anything. He just has to raise doubts about the credibility of the evidence provided by the Crown. And I had doubts before Mr. Bain got started, and I have as much doubt, if not more doubt, now having listened to Mr. Bate or watched Mr. Debate's cross-examination of Mr. Wright these past 2 days.
We're going to get a re-examination from the Crown after mm-hmm. Donald Bain is done with his mm-hmm. cross-examination. What does the Crown need to prove this bribery charge then?
First of all, the rules of the court limit the Crown's re-examination to those matters that are raised by Mr. Bain, okay, in the cross-examination. The re-examination by the Crown is not a second chance to do an examination in chief of Mr. Wright. They had their chance for that. But the Crown is typically allowed a re-examination in respect of those matters that they didn't raise in their own examination of Mr. Wright, but which Mr. Bain has raised in his cross-examination. So with those limitations in mind, I'm not so sure that the Crown can do anything more than perhaps rebut some of the argument arising from Mr. Bain's cross-examination about political conspiracy. Okay, Mr. Bain has tried to position Mr. Duffy, it would seem, as an innocent victim here. And I expect the Crown is going to try and show that Mr. Duffy was anything but an innocent victim of a conspiracy here, that he was very much a mover and shaker, if you like, of what took place. But I don't think that will prove to be sufficient to establish a conviction for a criminal offense.
You were a law clerk in the House of Commons for more than mm-hmm. a decade. Mm-hmm. You spent a lot of time, saw different governments in power. To your understanding, I mean, is this typically the way business is done in the House of Commons? Canadians will look at this and say, what the heck is going on up there?
Well, first of all, let me say that in my time at the House of Commons, over 20 years there, you can almost say there's nothing that's typical, that each issue when it comes along is unique in its own way, and gives rise to actions that might not have been seen before. But having said that, generally speaking, it is nothing surprising about the government, in this case, taking an active interest in how the Duffy affair or the complaints against other senators are being handled by the Senate. The government, don't forget, has in the Senate a senator appointed as the government leader in the Senate. I mean, clearly that person is there to represent the government's interests. So the government typically has interests in what's going on in the Senate. And understandably, the Prime Minister or staff on his behalf might take an active interest in some of those matters, as they have done here. Now, one may question the propriety of some of the interventions they made, but that's another issue. But the fact that they took an active interest is not unusual or surprising.
But taking an active interest and going to lengths to create this scenario, the lengths that they went to here, is this normal?
Well, again, what's normal in a political situation? I don't know what the norm is, but it is the case, as you well know, I'm sure, that politicians generally are often trying to spin the facts in their public statements in such a way that if serves their political interests, or at least minimizes the damage done to their political interests, their political brand, as it's called. So in a sense, management of the issue in the public domain is part of what politics is about. Now, there's a line somewhere, you might argue, and understandably so, beyond which it's no longer a matter of just managing the facts, but actually actively deceiving the public through the invention of facts that are untrue. And that doesn't make it a criminal offense, but it certainly, in the minds of many Canadians, makes the activity rather offensive. And I think that's what we're seeing now here, is the exposure of political activity behind closed doors of a kind that is, in the minds of many Canadians, quite dishonest and deceiving of Canadians, and not something they would expect their public officials to be doing. But that's a political issue. I don't know that necessarily supports the finding of a criminal conduct, but nonetheless, it's offensive to many Canadians, and I think that I won't say that that's commonplace. No, that inventing new facts or blatantly stating something that's untrue is clearly not the normal practice, and it can become a serious problem for any politician who is caught doing so.
This scenario around Duffy went beyond regular spin, and the facts that were given to the public were not the truth. Are you disappointed, as somebody who served Parliament for so long, are you disappointed to see that happen?
What's particularly disappointing is that the Prime Minister has yet to accept responsibility for what his staff did. And even if he was to explain it as a kind of a nominal responsibility, it nonetheless is his responsibility. They are his staff. They would not be doing these things if they didn't think it was acceptable to him as their boss. I'm disappointed that a man holds the office of Prime Minister for as many years as he has, and it has not yet been impressed upon him sufficiently that he has a duty to all Canadians to be truthful and maintain a proper level of moral integrity in carrying out his duties. Where does the buck stop?
That was Rob Walsh, who served as a law clerk to the House of Commons for more than 10 years before his retirement in 2012.
Still to come, Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne sits down with Paul Wells to talk about butting heads with Stephen Harper. We speak with a new star candidate for the NDP, and the Macleans panel discusses the Duffy trial and the campaign trail.
Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Macleans Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we speak with a star candidate for the NDP who wants to take out the current finance minister, and the Macleans panel joins us to discuss the Duffy trial and the news on the campaign trail. But first,
during this election campaign, Conservative leader Stephen Harper isn't just attacking his political opponents on the federal stage. He's also doing battle with the premiers. His main target has been Ontario Liberal Premier Kathleen Wynne. She is proposing a new Ontario pension plan, which has led to a war of words between the two, with Harper trying to frame the new plan as a new payroll tax. Macleans political editor Paul Wells went to Toronto to sit down with Wynne for a one-on-one interview. The full interview can be found at macleans.ca, but here is an edited portion of the discussion about locking horns with Harper.
How did you get into this fight with the Prime Minister?
Well, I guess by saying that we were going to introduce an Ontario retirement pension plan when he decided that we weren't, as a country, going to see an enhanced Canada pension plan, even though finance ministers across the country said that that was necessary. So, you know, this isn't... This isn't a political fight from my perspective. This is a very fundamental difference in opinion about what's needed in the country and for people's retirement security.
Now, there was an extraordinary moment in a news conference that he gave the other day. He was asked questions about other subjects, and then, not having been asked about your plans for the pension, he decided he would deliver an answer anyway. And he called it a very bad idea. He called it a huge tax hike. Let's break that down. Why would it not be accurate to call it a huge tax hike?
Well, taxes is money that goes into a government's treasury to deliver services. This is an investment in people's future. This is a savings plan to help people in their retirement. I mean, what's motivating this, Paul, is that we know that people are not saving enough. So people in their 20s and 30s and 40s are not able to save enough. And so they are worried about their security in their retirement. And so that's why finance ministers across the country a couple of years ago were talking about the need for an enhancement to the CPP. When that didn't happen, we took the position that it was responsible for the Ontario government to set up a plan that would help with people's retirement security.
Call it a tax, call it an investment. it will reduce the take-home pay in 2017, 2018 of people who have no choice on whether to participate in the plan.
Well, as I've said a number of times, the Canada Pension Plan is pretty much universally regarded as a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people rely on it, they know it's there, and there's really no public debate about whether the Canada Pension Plan should exist or not. And so this is analogous to that kind of plan, you know, that that is an investment in people's future. And that's how people think about pensions. They think about pensions as an investment in their future. They see it as a savings vehicle,
okay,
which is why there's support for it. You know, I ran on this. I ran, and we put it in our budget in 2014. We ran on it in our platform, and were returned with a mandate in June of 2014.
And yet what you're not saying, the Prime Minister and I will have to agree to disagree. You're saying, I would like a different Prime Minister. Was that a hard decision to make?
Well, I had said the Prime Minister and I will have to agree to disagree because we've been, you know, we've had this disagreement for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we need a change in government at the federal level. I have said that, and I believe that because I think that the example of the Ontario Retirement Pension Plan is only one example. There are other areas where this Prime Minister has decided he is not going to work with the premiers, and in deciding that doesn't meet with us, doesn't talk to us, doesn't engage us as a group.
So now I guess the question is, what are you going to do about it? You will actively campaign. You'll be showing up with Justin Trudeau on the campaign trail.
Well, you know, as Prime Minister Harper supported Tim Hudak in the last provincial election, and his MPs supported the Conservative candidates, we'll be working in ridings. That's actually no different than it's been for many elections. And as Justin Trudeau showed up at rallies and came out with me during our campaign, I will do the same for him. My job is as Premier of Ontario, so I'm going to be doing that job. But yeah, to the extent that I'm engaged in political activity, I'll be supporting Justin.
Can this relationship between a Liberal government at Queen's Park and a Conservative government on Parliament Hill be repaired?
The relationship has been difficult for some time. That doesn't mean that there aren't areas where we've worked together. So the auto sector, for example, we have officials who work together all the time, and there have been joint announcements. There have been some cooperation, for example, around working with First Nations and water, and the Prime Minister and I had a conversation about that. I would expect, Paul, that those things would carry on. It will never be a warm relationship, that's a given, but my job as the Premier of Ontario is to make sure that we find ways to cooperate where we can, and we have continually tried to reach out and make the relationship work, but we haven't received a warm reception.
You're currently backing the third place horse in this federal race. Does that make you nervous?
I think it's a long campaign.
Uh-huh.
I don't think anybody knows where this campaign is going, and I believe in what Justin stands for, and I'm going to work to support him any way I can.
Where is Tom Mulcair and the New Democrats in all of these debates?
Well, I don't know Tom Mulcair very well. I've met him at public events. You know, it's been a perfectly amicable relationship. From what he says, he would be open to working with the provinces. I have to take him at face value. I think some of his policies are pretty unrealistic. You know, I don't know what the child care policy would mean for the province of Ontario. I think it hasn't all been revealed at this point, but I do know what Justin stands for, and I have said that we need a Prime Minister who will work with the provinces, and I think either one of them would, but obviously I understand more about and believe in what Justin stands for.
That was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells interviewing Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne. There's a lot more to that interview. To check out the video, head to macleans.ca.
One of the biggest challenges in this election campaign for New Democrat leader Thomas Mulcair is combating Stephen Harper's claims that the NDP would be a risky, reckless choice to run the Canadian economy.
Now, this week, Mulcair announced that Andrew Thompson, a former NDP finance minister in Saskatchewan, will be running for the federal party this time around. Thompson has spent the past few years working in the technology sector in Australia and Singapore. In his attempt to return to politics, Thompson is going up against a heavyweight. He's running to unseat Conservative Finance Minister Joe Oliver in the Toronto riding of Eglinton-Lawrence. Andrew Thompson spoke with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and John started off by asking how Thompson feels about being cast as the poster boy for NDP economic policy.
You know, I'm very happy to campaign on the record that we had in government, that the NDP has in government across this country. I do think as more and more people are looking at the NDP as forming a national government, they're looking to see, you know, what our experience is. And I'm really happy if that is that experience that I bring to this is seen as a positive in that. I have to say that I was really attracted to become more involved in the federal party as a result of Tom Mulcair's leadership. I mean, Tom has sat around the cabinet table in Quebec. He's got a really good understanding of what makes government work, of the trade-offs, of the balance that has to be there. And that spoke to me. So I do think you're going to see across the country a number of people who are carrying a very similar message forward.
Well, let me just see if I can make a link between your record in Saskatchewan included some tax cuts, a bit of a sparring with the federal government over transfer payments. Is there a way to connect the kinds of themes that you are associated with from your experience there with what you think the NDP on the federal level stands for in this campaign?
The big issues when we were in government, and I think are the big issues still facing the country today, are how do we balance the requirement for new investment in social programs, new investments in infrastructure, and a competitive tax system that's fair to all Canadians and to the various parts of the economy. That is really the crux of the debate today. And frankly, I believe that the Conservatives and Joe Oliver and Stephen Harper have gotten it wrong. The plan that they put forward has not worked. We've gone through a resource boom, and we've seen a loss of jobs in the manufacturing sector. We've not seen the type of growth that we should in other sectors coming out of a boom mentality. And, you know, coming from a province that has gone through boom and bust before with resources, we always know that during good times, you have to put the money aside to support the programs, invest in new industries that are going to carry you forward when there's the down times. And that's been really one of the big things that I think I can add to this debate is an understanding of how that actually works in practice.
You know, it's interesting talking about the coming from Saskatchewan, you'd have a good feel for the importance of the resource sector to certainly to the western provinces and really, you know, in different ways, all the provinces. How do you feel about the way the debate is going on right now? Mr. Mulcair has been under some fire for not just coming out unequivocally in favor of, for example, the Energy East pipeline project. There's been some question about what the NDP's stance on carbon emissions and how that might affect the energy sector would play out. How do you like to frame that? How do you see those issues?
I think in a lot of ways this is a failure of where the Conservatives have come from. The lack of clarity on, not only clarity, but frankly, trustworthiness in terms of the approach for moving forward with projects like Energy East has simply muddied the water. This makes it very hard for business to be able to put forward its case. It makes it very hard for those who are concerned at the local level, whether it's about land rights or about the environment, to put forward their case. We need a different process. And I am very pleased to see that Tom Mulcair has picked that up. He's got, you know, the right experience coming from the environment portfolio that he looked after in Quebec to understand how to manage that balance. On the broader issue of resource development, there is no doubt that we need to continue to see more resource development. It has to be sustainable. And in the context of today, it needs to also fit within our environmental paradigm. I was one of the people that was disappointed when I was a Minister of Energy to see the Conservatives were pulling out of Kyoto, and they were starting to move away from those kind of agreements that would put in place a framework for sustainable development. So I do believe you can have both natural resource development and do it in a sustainable way that looks after your environmental issues.
Don't you think, though, that in some cases we have people, even I think people who are you know, very serious on this issue and show goodwill, who are reluctant to say, look, that there are at the very least going to be tough short-term decisions that are going to have to be made. I mean, if we put a serious price on carbon in Canada, that would be, you know, that would be something that the energy sector would have to make painful adjustments to, would it not?
So So one of the challenges we have, obviously, is we're in an integrated economy, and we've got to be mindful of that. That's why, you know, moving forward with multilateral agreements, having a clear action plan here within our own country is really important. And that's the groundwork that has not been done by the Conservative government. You know, they have turned a blind eye to the environmental concerns that I think a lot of Canadians, including myself, do share. And they have not provided any kind of real leadership to industry about how to mitigate and manage that. They have really sat on the sidelines as we've gone through this period of resource boom and not thought at all about the tough issues that are going to come home to roost very shortly.
Let me ask you about taxation. I know there's nothing on the books in the NDP platform that would suggest this is going to be the party that's in favor of big tax increases, although I know there is the idea that there would be some increase in corporate taxes and a cut in small business taxes. But if people said to you, well, look, we're just apprehensive. I'm thinking about maybe Ontario voters. We're apprehensive about whether or not an NDP government would raise taxes. How would you respond to that?
I think it's a mistake to look at taxes as either inherently good or bad. I mean, taxes are there to serve a purpose, which is to pay for social programs and to help manage, and in some cases, stimulate economic growth. Mm. And that's really how we need to start looking at this. We have to start to find that balance. And that's, you're seeing that in the NDP platform in this campaign. Yes, we are going to advocate for an increase in corporate income taxes. We are looking to rebalance that way. But at the same time, we are also providing targeted tax relief to industries that need support today.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with NDP candidate Andrew Thompson, who's trying to unseat Conservative Joe Oliver, who has been serving as the finance minister.
Coming up after the break, the McLean's panel.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Associate Editor for McLean's, Aaron Wary, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me here, guys.
Good to be here.
All right, so we have the Duffy trial, and we'll discuss that first because we also have a campaign going on, a lot going on there as well. But let's take a look at Duffy at the moment. A lot has come out in this trial, especially with the most recent document dump of hundreds and hundreds of pages of emails, as well as the testimony from Nigel Wright. Aaron, we'll start with you. What kind of damage do you think is going to be inflicted on the Conservative Party as a result of all of this attention, if there's any damage at all?
I think it is damaging. I mean, I think the idea, there was a kind of a brief, I think, idea at the start that this wasn't going to be too bad. And it may not be. It may not be pivotal. This may not swing the entire election. But I think as it's become clear how much we now have in the public realm and how much is being revived and how many questions are being brought back, I think people are starting to realize how big this whole mess is. You know, when Nigel Wright started testifying, there was that moment when he says that he didn't tell the Prime Minister about the original plan to have the party pay back the money. And I think there was a moment there where people thought, oh, well, there's no bombshell here. But then it's like, oh, right, but there's also the stuff they did with the committee, and there's Irving Gerstein's apparent contact with Deloitte, and there's the drafting of media lines, and now, as I wrote about for today and as came out kind of in yesterday's stuff, there's this memo to the Prime Minister explaining, you know, how they want to get around the Senate residency question. And there's even the Prime Minister via Ray Novak quotes on the record, apparently, well, not on the record, but exact quotes from the Prime Minister. You know, there's just so much going on here, and it's brought back, it's brought it all back. If people had forgotten about how complicated and convoluted this was, I think it's brought it all back.
It's an unhappy look at what happens behind the scenes in a crisis like this. John, do you think that this is just par for the course for any prime minister's office in dealing with a crisis like this? Or was there something that went beyond? Was there a line that was crossed here in dealing with the Duffy scandal?
Hard to know what's gone on in past prime minister's offices. I don't think we've ever seen as detailed a trail as this. I don't doubt that every senior politician's office spends some time on damage control and messaging and media stuff, right? So it's not obvious to me that this is different in kind. I think it's probably different in a sense in that the the stakes obviously were large here, and the thresholds that people were willing to step across, I think particularly in trying to tamper with that Deloitte audit, were fairly straightforward. On the other hand, just listening to Aaron recount it, you know, this trial's going to go on recess again, I believe, late this month, right?
August 28th,
and not come back until November, till after the campaign. So what we're going to have here is a murky, complex, messy situation that most people are not going to sort out. Doesn't matter what happens in a few years. I don't think most Canadian voters are going to sort it out. It's going to be on. It's going to fall into the background for most of this campaign. I will be, frankly, surprised if it ends up having the kind of traction that this week we feel like it might have.
All right, so you mentioned the campaign. Let's turn the focus to the campaign, because Duffy has definitely been a distraction from what's actually happening in terms of policy announcements from the parties. And I think they're being overshadowed anyway with what's been going on with Duffy. So, Aaron, what have you been noticing this week on the campaign trail? What sort of issues have come out there that maybe Canadians haven't noticed?
It's been, you know, people say, I've read people say, well, this campaign's kind of boring, or it's kind of lifeless. There's been sort of this burst of policy. Whether we're having great discussions about it is another question, but you know, Trudeau was out yesterday on First Nations education. We had the flare-up with Linda McQuaig and the NDP candidate in Toronto Centre, and these questions about resource development and climate change. The Conservatives were out on safe injection sites. The NDP's out today on the Parliamentary Budget Officer. There's actually a lot going on here. There's actually a fair amount of policy now being put out. And hopefully, possibly, with this long campaign that we have, that these discussions will kind of churn a bit. Whether, you know, it's, I think there are interesting questions about kind of how campaigns are run and whether or not we're able to kind of have discussions about these policies that are any more than just sort of sound bites. But you can't say that this campaign is substance free. It maybe hasn't focused on two or three questions, but there's a fair amount out there now.
I look, Carmack, you know, there's points where you see those contrasts being sharpened, eh? So the Prime Minister announces a classic kind of Tory niche policy. Let's let people withdraw 10 grand more from their RSPs to put towards a down payment on a house, the so-called home buyers program. Let's expand it so people can get, I think it's 35,000 rather than 25,000. Classic Tory policy, aimed at people buying houses. They like that kind of sort of, you know, people in the middle class who are trying to become homeowners. A measure that has tax implications very, very much in the wheelhouse of the Conservative Party. At the same time, we have Justin Trudeau announcing, I think it's $2.6 billion in... pardon me?
I think I believe it's $3.6.
Is it $3.6 for the Aboriginal... Anyway, a lot of money for Aboriginal education in a program that would involve deals on a provincial or regional basis, sort of ambitious big programs. This is sort of classic Liberal stuff set against classic Tory stuff. So as the campaign goes on, if we see more of this, there's no question that the distinctions will be drawn. I don't mean to exclude the NDP from this, but just that contrast struck me as a striking one this week.
How do you guys think the parties keep the focus on their policies when all of this is going on with the Duffy trial and the focus, at least of the national media, is on what's happening in an Ottawa courthouse rather than on the campaign trail?
Yeah, arguably for the Liberals and the New Democrats, they're kind of happy to let this have the oxygen. I think they probably realize they've got several weeks to really focus on their policies. It's been interesting to watch the Conservatives try to deal with the specter of the Duffy trial. I don't know that they're really succeeding in drawing any attention away from it. I think it's kind of hard
waiting,
to look away.
It's a waiting game for them. They're waiting for the trial to recess again. That'll take them into September. Most people have a sort of a psychological feeling that the real campaign will begin on Labor Day anyway, right? So they're thinking by then, Duffy trial will be off. We'll have a clean field in September, the first couple weeks of October, to make the race really gel into whatever it's going to be.
All right. Thanks very much, guys. Really appreciate it. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, Maclean's Associate Editor Aaron Wary, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode. Remember to check out the other podcasts from Maclean's. We have The Thrill, which is our podcast about pop culture, and there's Bibliopod, our podcast about the latest in books.
But for more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.